Hello, welcome to Series 5, Episode 12 of the Prompted by Nature podcast. I'm Helen and I hope you're okay. I realise that I never say who I am anymore when I introduce the podcast, so I thought I'd start by saying I'm Helen, because I am. I hope you're doing well this week. So the action point straight in is to donate, if you can, to the Turkey-Syria Earthquake Fund Appeal. If you're in the UK, you can do that through the DEC, which is an umbrella organisation for lots of different charities who are supporting communities and trying to get help over there. But do look into the reputable charities working in your country to help, and donate if you can. So before I tell you about today's conversation, I wanted to remind you that my Substack newsletter is now available via the Substack app or in your inbox when you sign up. You can sign up for free or you can be a paid subscriber. It's £5 a month or £40 for the year, which is a saving of £1.70 on the monthly price. It works out about £3.30 a month if you pay for the year. All of the information about what's included in each option is over on my Substack page, which is promptedbynature.substack.com, and in the show notes for this episode. I hope you'll join me for more prompts, workbooks, e-zines, and nature-inspired creativity and community. It's a really lovely space. Whether you're paid or free, I think you'll get a lot out of it. So back to the episode. Today, I am thrilled to release my conversation with the lovely Caro Giles, whose book 12 Moons is now available and published by Harper North. Caro Giles is a writer based in Northumberland. Her words are inspired by her local landscape, the wide empty beaches and the Cheviot Hills. She writes honestly about what it means to be a woman, a mother and a carer, and about the value in taking the road less travelled. Her writing appears in journals, press and periodicals, including a monthly column in Psychologies. In 2021, she was named BBC Countryfile's New Nature Writer of the Year. In this conversation, we discuss the story behind the memoir 12 Moons and how Caro came to write it, accountability in your writing practice, how she found her unique voice, how her role as a parent carer has impacted that voice and the way that she approaches her work, Caro's personal relationship with the moon, and you know we love talking about the moon on this podcast, how Caro approached the book and her writing process, her life as a singer and a musician, what she's learned that she wants to pass on, and her vision for the future. You can find Caro on Twitter and Instagram at Caro Giles Writes, that's CaroGilesWrites. And her book 12 Moons is now available via the Prompted by Nature bookshop on bookshop.org, which you can find a link to on my website or at your local bookshop, of course. And then once we've supported our local bookshop or podcast, we then post a review on Amazon. Episodes that would work really well with this conversation are from Series 2, Episode 10A, Marshall Farrell, My Garden, My Teacher. Series 3, Episode 2A, Stella Tomlinson, Priestesshood and Earth-Based Spirituality, in which we talked quite a lot about the moon. Series 4, Episode 2A, Rebecca Schiller, Earthed. And Series 4, Episode 7A, Ben Myers, Writing with the Land. As always, I'm over at the website www.promptedbynature.co.uk, where you can find the information about my upcoming day retreats and writing courses in East Sussex, as well as all the links to the bookshop and the Substack newsletter. I'm always on at prompted.by.nature on Instagram, and I hope you can join me there. I really hope you love this episode. The prompt that accompanies it will be out on Tuesday. Happy listening, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye.
Hi, I'm Caro Giles and I'm a writer, a musician living in Northumberland in the very, very far north of England, close to the borders of Scotland. And I've been a writer for the last few years and have recently written a memoir called 12 Moons, which is set in the landscape all around me, the beaches nearby and the hills. And it's the story of how I try to rediscover myself following a period of heartbreak and of illness within my family, and how I find solace in the landscape around me. So that's me.
As I said before, I'm really thrilled that you could join me so that we can talk about the book and your creativity and your writing, everything. But before we kind of get onto the book, I love hearing about people's backstories in terms of their kind of journey as a creative, a writer. So I would love to hear about, kind of how you got to this point of publishing a book. Have you always been creative? What's your kind of creative journey?
Okay, yeah, I have always been creative from when I was a child, and I always did lots of performing. So I did lots of amateur dramatics, and I did a lot of music. Music's always been a big part of my life. And when I left school, I went to drama school to train to be an actor. So I guess the desire to tell stories has always been there, just perhaps in another creative form. And I worked as a actor in theatre for about 10 years before I retrained as a teacher in order to be able to fund having a family, because being a creative doesn't always pay the bills very well. So yeah, I trained to be a teacher and worked as a music teacher, and really my creativity around those years of very tiny children and working in schools was through working with kids and through running choirs, which I also did outside of my teaching. And around that time, I started to blog about my experiences as a parent and my experiences of home educating my children, because my oldest child found school really stressful. And so I took her out of school and eventually had four very small children who were learning at home with me. And that was both a really wonderful experience, but also quite isolating, because we were living really remotely. And I felt that my identity as a person outside of being a mother was in danger of becoming lost. And so I found that blogging helped me to connect with other parents and carers, and helped me to just reflect a little bit upon my experience as a mother and as a woman and as a creative. And I guess that 12 moons came from that blogging, in terms of the themes that I was exploring around identity and around using nature as a classroom. So I guess that's how I decided to do a master's in creative writing after my marriage broke down, and I felt the need to have something really positive to focus on. And that was a master's in nature and travel writing. And I think that really cemented my love of writing about the landscape around me and gave me the confidence and the discipline to sit down and put my story onto the page and write a book.
I'd love to hear about your experience with the kind of, I don't want to say academic side of writing, because obviously the nature and travel writing course isn't academic as such, but I would love to hear about kind of how the impact that had on your writing in terms of the regularity of it, the way that you kind of developed your narrative voice. What part did that course play in, you know, how you write now?
I think the first thing that the course did was to validate the idea that I am a writer. So even though I'd had little articles published and I had a decent following for my blog, it still felt like I was a mum at home doing some writing. And it was hard to make the step to saying, I am a writer and my words hold value, and this is something that I can do. Try to do as a career. So I think firstly, being accepted onto the masters validated that for me. It also opened up my community. So my colleagues on the course were amazing, and we all became each other's biggest cheerleaders. And that did a lot in terms of helping me to feel less isolated as a parent carer living remotely in a lockdown. And just really helped my confidence. The other thing that the masters did was offer, it was a very, it was a master's that really helped me to understand the writing industry and the journalism industry. And it was a very hands-on course, which is what I really wanted, because I didn't really have the luxury of just enjoying doing some writing and seeing what happened. I needed to find a way to earn some money to support my family. So I specifically chose a course that would help me to make connections within the industry. So it was great from that point of view. But outside of the industry aspect of the course, there were opportunities to write essays and explore themes that we were interested in. And I did a lot of work around what writing in the field meant and research meant as a single parent carer, how I could manage to do that. That helped me to meet other people who were living in challenging situations but wanted to be creative and had creative careers. And fundamentally, the course required me to be writing a lot, and I had to find the space to do that. And I was forced to, you know, produce however many thousands of words each month for a portfolio, for an essay, for pitches I was doing. And so I had to find that time in the day. And that time in the day for me was the very, very early morning before my children were awake. And I think the nature of that time, often writing in the dark, often writing with candles, created a space which really lent itself to the themes in 12 Moons. But also, yeah, just meant I was writing every day. And then it was like a muscle that was getting stronger that I was using again and again.
And I was going to ask you about your kind of creative practice and how you, because you kind of refer to, you know, getting up early in the morning in the book. What does your writing practice look like now? Do you write every day, or is it, you know, is it consistent? Is it kind of, because I know that these things, well, I know for myself, these things kind of change, and I'll have a spurt of doing it every morning and then a spurt of like 2 weeks where I don't write. I just wondered how it looked for you right now.
Yeah, so right now I'm really in the thick of promoting 12 Moons. So my head is it's weird because the book is finished. Creatively, I've done that bit, but my head is still full of the story of 12 Moons because I'm talking about it, I'm writing about it, and I'm trying to connect with readers and explain why this book is something that they might want to read. So that is taking up a lot of my that uses a different type of energy to my writing energy. So, for example, if I get up when I get up early every morning anyway, I might be preparing for a podcast, or I might be writing an article for a magazine about 12 Moons. So my working day looks very different at the minute. But I have started writing another book, and I am starting to think about targets for how many words I want to write each week and how many times I can get up in the week when my children don't need me, and starting to try and put a bit of discipline back in place, which is what I needed to do to get my first book written. So, yeah, I think it does go in fits and starts. And what I try to do is really regularly regroup with myself and also use the community that I have online through Instagram and Twitter and through my writing group to hold myself to account. So I like to announce that I'm going to get up early for three mornings this week and write and produce 2,000 words or whatever it might be. And just by saying that I will do that, often that means that I will do that. So that there's that thing of being held accountable as well, which I think is really, really important.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how it's easier to be accountable, well, I find with myself, it's easier to be accountable to someone else than it is to yourself. You know, like, yeah, it's easier to say I'm going to do this and then think, well, someone knows I'm going to do this, which means I kind of have to.
Yeah, because I've said I will. I think the other thing that is challenging as probably challenging for anyone, but from my experience as a parent carer, I find that I always come last in the equation. So always there is an appointment or there is something more I should be doing for one of my children, to make their lives easier, to make all of our lives easier. And it's easy to put the writing right to the bottom of the pile. But actually, when I was writing 12 Moons, the kids became really accustomed to waking up and finding me writing, or me saying, oh, I've just had an idea, girls. when I'm driving or something, can someone just type these words down in my phone for me? Or can someone just write this down while I'm doing this? And they were really supportive of my creative practice. And I think there's something really lovely about that, about demonstrating, if you are a parent or carer, that this is something that's important to your sense of self-worth, and, you know, it's your job as well. And I think that's something that I've tried to keep showing the kids, and they are keen to see me writing. So yeah, that's something I've worked hard at.
And you kind of mentioned, you know, motherhood and that sort of thing. I'm a mum of two, and I wonder, because you kind of alluded to, you know, kind of losing yourself in the blur of motherhood, which I know kind of happened to me. How did it feel to get lost in all of that? And how did you come back? How did you find your way back to your voice?
I think I did get lost in the blur of motherhood, but I also got lost in a marriage that really sadly didn't work. And I think what I write about in 12 Moons is that sense of regret and loss and confusion over what you thought was going to be your life and turned out not to be, and there's a void, and what is going to fill that. So I think how I'm slowly finding my way back to myself, which some people might just call growing up and getting older as well, just learning about what life is, I think a lot of it's happened through writing. So being really brutally honest and writing myself onto the page. So actually physically producing a book that tells my story, that reminds me that I am here, that I have achieved things, that I have done things. And it's reading about other people who have done remarkable things. It's reading about other people whose families might look a little bit like mine, because part of writing this book was feeling that I'm on the edge of everything all the time, on the edge of the country, on the edge of an education system that is not working for my children, on the edge and now on the outside of a marriage. All of those things made me feel like I didn't quite belong anywhere. So I guess part of the joy of becoming a writer in midlife has been discovering a community and a tribe that I can be alongside, that I can explore ideas with. I can connect with people who've had similar experiences. I guess that's been the way I've been trying to find my way back to myself. I'm not sure I ever really knew who I was. I do think that lots of this is just getting older and having life experiences and life not being what you thought it was. But I think that creativity and learning about myself and finding a way to navigate life all are knitted together for me.
Yeah, I can completely relate to that. I turned 40 a couple of years ago, and I feel like that really, for me, was like, what did I do in my 30s? Like, what were my 30s about? I don't even really, it was such a, you know, I got lost in that sort of, oh, I didn't achieve anything. But now, like you say about that kind of growing up, writing in the kind of midlife years, if you like, it's completely different, I'm finding.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's to do with how little caring roles are valued in society. So when our children are tiny, and also if we're, so some of my children have complex needs, and so they need even more care, or different care, more intense care perhaps. Lots of that happens behind closed doors. It's all unpaid, but the value is huge, because we are working to support small children to become humans who will contribute and be part of society in whatever way that may be. But when we live in a society that doesn't value that, not even necessarily in a monetary way, but we live in a capitalist society, so, you know, money's important. When that caring is not valued, I think that really has an impact upon your own sense of, like, what is my worth, you know? So that all of that kind of political stuff is wrapped up in it as well, I think.
And well, it's, I was going to say for you, I'm not going to make any assumptions. It seems for you, the moon is this force that has been there, is there, will be there for you. So just to kind of contextualize a little bit, we talk about the moon quite a lot on the podcast because I just think it's wonderful as like a creative tool and all the moon phases and things. And I was just wondering, because obviously the book is called 12 Moons, when you first became aware of the moon phases and how that has enriched your life, guided your life, become an anchor point for you, and maybe how it might have guided your creativity or your creative life. I'd love to hear about your relationship with the moon.
Okay, so yeah, I wasn't any more aware of the moon than anybody else until I started writing this book, other than, I loved it when there was full moon, or I love looking up at the stars, just as anybody would like to do that. But when we went into lockdown, and specifically in the winter after, at the end of the lock, I think it was the second lockdown. Anyway, it was all lovely and hot, wasn't it, in the first lockdown, which took the edge off it for some people, although it was still horrendous. When it was dark and we were in lockdown, at that point my daughter became very, very poorly, and we really couldn't leave the house, and no one could really help us because of the we didn't want to transmit the virus to anyone. So I was really on my own with the kids, and I couldn't even get out into the wilderness, which would sometimes be really a joyous thing, just to go and like have a blast of fresh air on the beach. And so often we could only look out of the window, and I live in a town, so there were rooftops around me. I haven't got like a big view of a field or a beach or anything. All I can see is rooftops, and all I could see in the darkness was the moon. And so really I was forced to commune, I guess, with the moon and with the stars, because I couldn't get out the house. I couldn't see anything else, but I was really craving fresh air, and I was really craving communication with someone. I was very isolated, very vulnerable. And there just was something about opening my bathroom window, which I still do every night now, and looking up and seeing the moon and just thinking there's something else out there. It's really hard to describe. I'm not a religious person. I'm not particularly a kind of woo-woo, whatever. There was something about the brightness of the light and the brilliance of it, and the fact that the moon was always there, and I knew the moon was always there. And I think at that stage in my life, everything was so transient. It was chaotic. It was frightening. And I think there was something about the constant nature of the moon that really soothed me and kind of compelled me. I don't know.
And was it automatic that it became the thing that guided you through the book, in terms of, each chapter is named after the moon of that month?
That was partly an emotional thing, because the girls and I became quite obsessed with looking at the moon and watching for the phase of the moon, and what's the name of this moon, and where is the moon in the sky, and where's it rising, and all of that. We became really obsessed. But also, I knew I had a story to tell, but I knew that my story would not be as compelling if the structure was not just right. And I knew I needed to hang my story on something. And I was interested in writing in real time, to try and convey the urgency of my life. I like that way of writing. And I was looking for a more interesting way of doing it than saying, this is January, this is February. And so that's when the moons came into it. And I was interested as well in the history and the all the old names, the different cultural ideas behind it. I did quite a lot of reading around the moon. I read about the science behind the moon. I just tried to really immerse myself in it. And I liked a lot of the language about it. I liked the imagery, all of that. And I liked the link to the female cycle. I liked the fact that my sister, who lives on the other side of the world, could see the moon, and then I could see the moon, and I felt closer to her. there were just like, it just became obvious that that was the thing I needed to hang my story on.
And in terms of like the process of writing the book, I'm always really interested in how people construct a piece, you know, like this or any book, especially when it comes to nature writing. I think there's something slightly different about how things are constructed. Were you writing in sort of real time, if you like, or was it a reflection? Because obviously it's a memoir. How did you move through that process? How did it begin and how did it become this complete work?
Yeah. So I wrote the very opening of the book is the first bit of the book that I wrote. And that was that's a moment when I watched my daughter dancing on the landing and the moon is shining onto the landing through the window. That happened. And then the next morning I wrote that scene up and that became the beginning of the book. And then most of the book, up to about two thirds of the way through, was written in real time. So I would get up in the morning and I would be writing about something that had happened within the last week or so. I was constantly making notes every day, making notes, because I think by the summer holidays, it was really, really hard for me to still be committed to that writing discipline of writing every morning. My caring responsibilities were too great. There was something as well about the moon not being there as much and it being so light in the mornings. I found it harder to focus. Anyway, I was making lots of notes during those summer holidays. I then got COVID in the autumn, which meant I was too poorly to do anything. So the latter part of the book, I was writing up, I was using the notes that I'd written in real time, but most of the book was written in real time. And then towards the end of the book, I then went back to see where I needed to insert some of the historical stuff that I write about, some of the things that have happened to me previously in my life. But really, by the end of that first draft, the book was in quite good shape. And I think that's because I was really meticulous in terms of writing every day, even if it was just note form. I was writing down exactly what I was feeling, where I was, some of the specifics about the landscape around me, you know, the birds I'd seen or the specific colour of the sky. But really, the landscape was such an amazing starting point each time. I would just take a tiny detail and that would be, and then it would really lead me into a nice narrative moment. Yeah.
Mm. The reason I asked was that there is an immediacy to the narrative voice, I think, and it feels less of a reflection and more of a, this is, you know, this is being written as you're experiencing it. So yeah, I was really interested to know whether it makes sense to hear you say that you were noting things down as you went along and then it becomes a really long journey.
And I think it's mainly written in the present tense as well. And that's intentional because it is to reflect the kind of the mania of that, of some of the things that happened that year and the urgency and the kind of breathlessness, my breathlessness, you know, that's done on purpose. But yeah, I really love that. I really love that writing in the moment. That works really, really well for me. My next book is more reflective and I'm finding that a really interesting way to work because I have to think about it more. It kind of poured out of me, this book, although it was carefully crafted. The story was kind of there, ready to go, and the landscape was there and so inspiring that it felt like it could just pour onto the page.
And I wanted to ask you, you just mentioned the landscape, how I wanted to ask you about your relationship to nature and the elements, because that's such a huge part of this book, which is, I think, one of the most joyful things about the book. You know, there's you're going through some really difficult times, but in the background, there's always this, you know, the reliability, the constancy of nature and the elements. And I was kind of thinking about, I often ask people about their earliest memory of nature or an encounter with the natural world that really stands out to you and how that might have influenced you as you've kind of gone on.
Okay. So I didn't grow up in Northumberland. I was born near Northampton, but then when I was three, we moved to Devon. So some of my earliest memories of nature are in Devon. And we could see Dartmoor from the cottage that we lived in a village. And we had chickens at the end of the garden. And there was a field that just ran away from the side of the house, which was just like a playground for us. So I was really lucky when I was very little just to grow up in a really safe place where I could just get really muddy and run around. And I remember the bleakness of Dartmoor really strongly, kind of how imposing it was and how wild. I don't, it just feels like a backwash to my life, those early years. I think I was really fortunate that my mum's side of the family in particular were really into walking. My grandpa had always done lots of walking, and my granny actually, and it was just part of the thing that my family did. We always went for walks. So I think that's something that's been instilled into me. And then when we moved up to Yorkshire when I was 11, we were in the Yorkshire Dales, and that was really beautiful as well. And we used to do lots of walking there. I kind of became completely disconnected from nature, I think, when I left home, went to drama school, then moved up to London. I don't know how that happened, but I certainly came back to nature in a really big way once my first daughter was born, and I would stand at the top of the hill in London and just look out and not see any green and just feel slightly bereft. And I was really drawn to live somewhere a little bit more rurally. But now I really crave the city. So, you know, maybe I'm just maybe I don't know, the grass is always greener, isn't it? But yeah, for me, nature has become more important to me as I've got older, I think. And I think that it's something that's in my genes because I've always enjoyed being outside with my parents and with my brothers and my sister. And now it's the thing that really helps to regulate my children. So it's become an imperative that I can at any point be near a scrap of green or a beach or a river or something, because it just helps my children to be, because they find other parts of the world and society so hard to navigate.
I do think there's something. I mean, I know it's not all schools, but I do think that there's been a push recently to get kids outside more often and to integrate the kind of natural world into the classroom a bit more. I mean, obviously, it's not perfect in terms of like the way that it's delivered or the regularity with which it's delivered, but I think there is something so vital and integral about incorporating the natural world into one's life and into one's children's life, more importantly.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, from that point of view, it's a massive privilege for me to live where I live, where I have access to the most amazing countryside. And everybody doesn't have that access. But then people in cities, I guess, have access to, you know, amazing cultural opportunities, museums and stuff. So it's, you know, there are different positives to living in different places. But I do think, in terms of where we're at with the climate crisis, it's really crucial that kids have a chance to spend time in nature and understand what we stand to lose, and learn to love nature so that they're so that yeah so that they really want to look after it, so they know it can still be here for future generations.
I was going to say that too, actually. One of the things that I really liked was, obviously you're talking a lot about your girls and your own experiences, but there were these like little spatterings of not social commentary, but where you do bring that in because it, and I could really, really relate to that, where you're taking so much joy from something, from being outside, from being in the water or whatever, and then this little thing will come in about, climate breakdown or whatever it might be. And I thought that to me felt very genuine is the wrong word, but it felt I could really feel that aspect of it where it just comes in and you can't help it.
I'm really pleased that you picked up on that, because I'm sometimes labelled a nature writer, because I I won a nature writing competition, and because I write about nature, but I don't really class myself as a nature writer. I just write kind of, I'm a life writer or a place writer maybe. But on my course, we had lots of discussions around what is nature writing. And obviously it's a really broad church. There are people who know lots about specific aspects of nature, people who write about the climate crisis, people who write memoir like me, but touch on nature. And you know, there's room for all of us, but I always wonder how much of a responsibility do we have as writers to address the challenges faced by the natural world. And I didn't want to particularly be political about it, or to say that I could hold a place as a nature writer that, you know, could sway anything or make that kind of commentary. But I can't help but think when I'm outside with my kids that we're so lucky to be able to experience that. And my children really talk about it more than I do, the way we're breaking our world, the way we're burning our world. So really it was impossible not to comment on it in some way. But in terms of nature writing, I just think if you are writing about your environment in a way that comes from, you know, love and nourishment and, you know, like a deep desire to be immersed in that landscape, that is also serving a purpose, as well as kind of being really strident politically, because you're saying this is a beautiful place. You're sharing that love of a place with the reader, and hopefully that makes the reader think, yeah, you know, we need to look after our world, we need to look after our environment. Even if it's kind of quite a soft approach, I still think I do hold some responsibility to consider that, you know.
I really appreciate that as well. I think it's very easy to divorce yourself from it. And like you say, like, there's space for everyone. You don't, you know, if you're writing about nature, you don't have to write about that. But for me personally, that was, I think, what I related to the most was, like, yeah, that appreciation and feeling like you're part of it, but then that little kind of niggling thing that comes in every now and again.
Yeah, and I think what some people take issue with inverted commas nature writers is when people do perhaps what I have done, which is place myself at the center of the story. But I don't define myself as a nature writer. And actually, if my story is living in the middle of nowhere and being on a beach or, you know, climbing up a mountain, then I think it's valid to write about that environment and my experience of being in it. I know people would disagree, and I'm interested to have those discussions with people.
But also I think you, as someone encountering nature, you bring to that, you know, everybody's interpretation of nature is going to be different, because we all bring different things when we're in, you know, our past experiences, our culture, whatever it might be, we bring that into our encounters with nature. So yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and I think as well, coming from a, if you're honest about coming from a place where you don't know everything about nature, then that's a really good thing to do as well. We talked about that on my course quite a lot. We say, oh, I don't know how to write about this because I've never seen this, or I haven't studied that before. You know, talk about that, put that into the writing. You know, talk about your own experience of what you don't know and what you want to learn. I think people want to know about that process and want to understand and not feel intimidated by people writing about nature, because, you know, it's there. It should be there for everyone. It should be accessible for everyone, not just people who are privileged enough to always be in nature, or privileged enough to have, you know, learned lots about it, read lots about it.
And also I feel like there is a sense with yourself and your girls where there is no boundary between your experiences and the natural world. They are just, you know, there are some really key scenes, I think, like when you're on the beaches and you're going out swimming, and some of them are, you know, you've got one of the girls looking at, I think, like a rock pool, or just kind of generally investigating. And it feels there is that immersion where those boundaries are blurred. And I think that's so important in inverted commas nature writing, is because I think it's easy to see humans and the natural world as being different, but actually it's, exactly, you know, lots of people using the term other than human now. And I think, yeah, there are lots of blurred boundaries in the book where you and your girls are very much nature and part of nature.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I don't know at what point we became so separated from it and at what point we became other. That's really interesting. I also, so there are times, like you say, when we're completely immersed in nature and it's like we are nature, we are the sea, we are, you know, the wind, whatever we are. But also I wanted to highlight the issue of accessibility to nature for lots of families. So in my case, some of my children have lots of sensory issues. And so being outside, or the idea of going outside into a different, where the air might feel different or the sounds will be different, can be really, really challenging. At one point, my oldest daughter was in a wheelchair. Access to nature was a really, really difficult. So I also wanted readers to think about that as well, that even people who live remotely and in theory have access to nature, if their family looks a little bit different, if their family's needs are a little bit different, that access to nature can be something that is challenging at times.
Yeah, and I do think that's the kind of beauty of nature writing, is that it can bring in all of these things. It raises all of these points, and it's a nice in, if you like, to being able to discuss these in a really open and genuine way. I think that's such an important part of it. So I wanted to ask you also, I'm always fascinated with musicians because I'm not one. I like listening to music, but that's about it. I would love to hear about your work as a singer, which you kind of talk about in the book, and the part that the voice plays as a tool for self-expression for you, but also because you lead choirs, how you've seen that kind of play out. Mm-hmm. And also perhaps, I don't know, a way of connecting to the natural world or the other than human world.
Okay, so I always have, I'm not from a particularly musical family. Like my dad's a beautiful singer, but he never had the opportunity to do any music when he was at school. And my mum is also a beautiful singer, played the piano a bit, and they both enjoy music, but it wasn't really that much of a tradition in my childhood. They were just very, very encouraging of my love of music and supporting me to have piano lessons and things like that. So I don't know where my musicality comes from, but it's something that I carry with me everywhere. And I used to sing, there's a bit in the book where I write about singing in the church choir. I loved that, singing kind of in semi-darkness with the candles. And I loved the discipline of the church anthems. I loved the harmonies. Even though I'm not religious, I still am really drawn to lots of that sacred music. I used to love the performance aspect of singing, so it really tied in with the theatre and the drama that I did. So I love that. And yeah, I'm losing my thread because I'm just getting lost in some of the harmonies I'm thinking about. Last night I was working with my women's singing group in my lounge, and I was thinking about, like, it was really hard for me to manage that because doing anything in the evenings is really hard because my kids really need me in the evenings. But I want to try and find space to do that singing. And through, I think something happened through lockdown where no one was allowed to sing. That felt like something really fundamental had been stripped away for me, because I always had sung in choirs and sung in groups. And we were now told that if we sang, we were dangerous, our breath was dangerous. And that felt really stifling for me, actually. And I started doing a thing in lockdown where I would just layer up my own voice on an app, just because I really was desperate to create harmonies. And it wasn't at all the same as singing with other people. You couldn't play around with it in the same way, but it was all I had. And then once lockdown started to ease a little bit, some of the women I sang with were in touch with me saying, oh, you know, Cara, when can we sing again? And I said, you know, it's just not safe to sing inside. We can't sing inside, but would you be interested in singing outside? Someone had a garden. Someone had a field that we could sing in next to their farm. And another lady had a garden that we could sing in. And so I set up a few of those sessions. And Yeah, it was just like it was the loveliest thing. I also was singing on beaches and making recordings on my own and putting those videos up, and just, yeah, there's something, it's linked to the themes in the book about finding a voice and feeling like your breath has been stifled and all those things. I just, it's something that I can't not do. I think perhaps even more than writing, I have to sing and I have to play. Yeah, it's just really part of who I am. It's like when I'm singing, like I love to play the piano or the clarinet or my ukulele or whatever, but when I sing, it's just me and it's really raw and I am the instrument and everything comes from me. And I find it a really emotional thing to be singing. Yeah.
I wonder if there's something there about like linking kind of similarities between the place you go to when you sing, as in internally, and the place you go to when you're like in the water or like, you know, the landscape. Mm-hmm. It feels to me like there is something about the voice. I spoke to a folk singer a few weeks ago and we were talking about, you know, the natural voice. She does work around the natural voice, and yeah, it feels like there's a link between our natural voice and the elements and the landscape and nature as a whole.
Yeah, I think, and when people talk about meditation, I find it really hard to meditate. I'm like such a busy head all the time and a million children and all of that, and my energy is always to be moving around. But there's definitely something really meditative for me about singing, about swimming in cold water, about like walking into really, really strong wind. Is it something, I don't know, I'm just thinking, is it something about kind of being taken to the edge of yourself, being taken out of yourself and being allowed to, obviously singing is really controlled, but actually there's something quite primal about it. And it's nice to feel out of control sometimes, to feel primal. I think that might be what the connection is.
I love that. That makes so much sense. Yeah. And it's not often that we're able to do that. Like I sing at home, but it's not ever something that I'm not in a choir or anything, but I can understand that. The sense of liberation, I suppose, maybe that's what it, like that sense, it's a freeing, you know, like.
I think, and it's also, so I think, I wish you would live near me because you can my ladies group, because all of the women most of the women that sing in my group, there are about 10, say that most of them, not all of them, say they have said to me they can't sing, they don't know how to use their voice. And that's that. And I think that goes beyond the singing as well. That's also part to do with self-esteem, to do with confidence, to do with like, where's my place? Where am I allowed to hold space? And so for me, it's like, it's a really holistic way to be with people and to work with people. Lots of the people over the years that I've worked with have come to singing because they have, they suffer from depression or anxiety. They've experienced trauma. They're going through a difficult period in their life, you know, a divorce, or they're grieving the loss of someone. And it is so healing to sing with other people and to sing in an environment where you feel safe to be, you know, to be held, to because it's quite a privilege really when people come to my home and feel able to sing with me, because they haven't had the professional training or don't have the confidence around music that I have. But they always leave a little bit taller, or they might cry and leave feeling that they've been heard or had a little space to be. There's something very powerful about singing, and it's definitely linked to the kind of the wildness and the just finding a way to be really connected with yourself.
As you were speaking, I was thinking of near where I work, there's a little woodland that I go for a walk in sometimes, and you know, it's all the birds and everything, but it's the robin. Whether it's the same one, I don't know, but there's a robin there. And what I love about him, them, it, whatever, is the singing for the joy of singing. I'm just going to sing. And just sometimes you can hear someone singing back, but it's that they're just up there having a little singing a little tune to themselves. It's just
really nice. And just that connection as well, isn't it? We were singing last night and we were just doing some a cappella stuff. I'd done this arrangement and it was a little bit tricky. And we finished on a note and we weren't all on the right note. And we kept practicing it and we kept listening and we had to listen harder and harder. And how can we make sure that we're creating a nice sound together? And there's something quite magical about allowing yourself to become that connected to someone, giving yourself the space to do that. I think we're all so busy all the time and all so out of tune, not just with nature, but with each other, aren't we? So music's a really nice way to feel that we can come back to each other, I think.
Definitely. So I've got another couple of questions, and these are two that I ask everyone at the end of each chat. So the first one is whether you have a lesson that you've kind of learnt on your journey that you would like to sort of pass on to listeners.
Yeah, I thought there were a couple of things that spring to mind when you asked me that. So one of them is that leaving the house, going outside, always shifts things. And that's really true for me. But I'm mindful that everybody can't leave the house, and I don't want to say something that will make people feel excluded. I don't even mean, like, I used to think, yeah, going for a run, that's great, that will change things, I'll go outside, I'll go for a run. Then life happened and now I can't always leave the house to go for a run. Sometimes going out of the house for me might mean just opening my window and breathing in the air that's outside. But even an act as tiny as that always shifts things that might be feeling difficult for me. If you can go out and go for a walk or go for a swim, obviously that's amazing. But I often can't do that because of the needs of my children. And so sometimes even just, and you remember in lockdown when we couldn't even go for a walk, and just sitting on a balcony or sitting with an open window, sitting in a garden if you've got one, that was really life-saving for lots of us who felt claustrophobic. So one thing I've definitely learned is being in touch with the outside air will always shift things. And the other thing I thought was that, which I've learned through my writing practice, is that the tiniest tiny things can be the start of something bigger. So there are lots of sections in my book where I'm writing about going on the school run. And I used to always think, oh my God, the school run is desperate. I hated it. I just felt like I was a hollow woman on those school runs. I found them really difficult to, I found it difficult for them to be positive experiences. And probably lots of that was to do with the fact that my children found it very difficult to go into school. So they were really distressed. But I managed to reframe the school run into something magical in the writing of the book. And what it taught me was that even really mundane, tiny things, even, you know, something that is a split second, like today I took the kids for a walk before I spoke to you, and we saw a cormorant flying at really fast speed down the river. And I never see cormorants flying down a river, and its neck was really stretched out and it was amazing. And that image is staying with me, and probably at some point I'll make a note of that, and that will be a starting point for a piece of writing for me. So I guess what I've learned is that making a note of the tiniest things that you see or feel or experience can grow into something much bigger.
And that's so important, I think, just in terms of, I'm just listening to that and thinking, yes, like thinking that in terms of myself as someone who writes, sees themselves as a writer, but I, you know, often there's that pressure of like everything that you write has to be big or mean something. Or I love that idea of just honing in on the tiny details and
tiny
just,
thing. Yeah, like where you're talking to me there about the robin and another robin singing back. That's a tiny thing, but I'm already thinking of lots of, that's making me think about lots of different things to do with connection and to do with voice, and thinking about them being high up in the tree. You know, there's so much that can come out of just that tiny thing you've told me. So I just think that makes writing a bit less intimidating when you think about it and break it into little steps like that.
Absolutely. And so my last question is kind of casting your mind forward and envisioning a future that you would like to see. So I often say this can be personal, it could be universal, it can be big, it can be small. So just, yeah, casting your mind forward and envisioning the future, what do you see?
Okay, what I hope for.
Yeah.
Hope for in the future. It, mainly what I really, really hope for, and I've said this to everybody who's asked me this, is I hope for my children to be healthy, because I've had lots of years of several children not being healthy. So I hope for that. But part of that is about the world not feeling like an inclusive place for them. So I hope that through my writing, I connect with people who will start more conversations like this around what it means to exist alongside nature and exist alongside each other when perhaps we look a little bit different or behave a little bit differently or our needs are different. So on a kind of emotional level, that's what I really hope for. On a professional level, I really hope to get this second book written. I really hope that I can establish myself as an emotional writer of place who explores, you know, interesting themes around identity and family and, you know, being a woman, all those things. That's something I never could have even dreamed of 5-10 years ago. So I feel like the world is really opening up for me and for my family, and that's all I can hope for, really.
I loved listening to you say that. That was such an uplifting statement of almost like intent, you know?
I feel I just kind of want to garner the confidence that I have got from writing this book and like move forward with that, basically.
Amazing. So before we finish off, can you just let people know where they can find the book, where they can find you, all the good stuff?
Thank you. Yeah, so 12 Moons is published now, so you can get that in any bookshops online. That's available, published by Harper North. Also an audio book for anybody who prefers to listen. I have really enjoyed recording the audio for that. I think it's quite a magical experience, so check that out if you prefer to consume your books that way. Yeah, that's me. You can find me online on Instagram. I love to engage with people on Instagram. It's at Caro Giles Writes, or on Twitter with the same handle. So please get in touch. I would really, really love to hear from you.
Thank you so much for writing the book and for just being an authentic voice in the space.
I've loved talking to you, and thank you so much. It's nice to meet someone who wants to talk about moons, because it's felt like a bit of a niche thing, but I hope that this my story is something that's really universal, that lots of people will be able to connect with. Thanks so much for having me.